Hi, friends, and welcome back to Crime Ghoul, a true crime podcast where I'm your host, Brittany, accompanied by my co-host, my pup, Kylo. And we love to bring you all things true crime. So how are we doing today? I hope everyone is good. I hope you were able to tune in to my last episode, Vampires in Kentucky. If not, that's cool. I'm glad to see you here on Halloween, and happy Halloween indeed. And today we will be talking about someone who thought that they were a 300-year-old werewolf. So yeah, there's that. Anywho, shall we jump into it? I think so. So here's your cue. Go brew yourself a cup of coffee, pour yourself a glass of wine, or perhaps take a shot of whiskey, because as always, these true crime cases are not for the faint of heart. Thank you so much for listening. Well, welcome back, friends. I hope you had an amazing Halloween weekend, and I hope you're having an even better Halloween. If you're tuning in later on in the week, I hope your Halloween was great and all of your spooky season activities held up to your expectations. And yeah, I just hope you were spooky as hell and, you know, enjoyed your pumpkin beers, your hard ciders, and whatever else you guys are drinking, whether it's just hot chocolate, a nice warm cup of coffee, tea. I hope it was all good, and I hope you had all the sweater weather feels. So the holiday season is on the horizon. That's either a good thing for some or a bad thing for others, but nevertheless, it is on the horizon. But here we are, and we're going to take in this last drop of spooky season and talk about a case that involves someone who believed that he was a 300-year-old werewolf. Yeah. If you tuned in last week, you'll know we covered the case of Rod Ferrell, who was a 16-year-old that believes he was a 500-year-old vampire. So as you can see, I'm continuing with this Ghoultober-themed series of episodes that, you know, include cases that just give me the heebie-jeebies, the spooks, the chills, the hairs stand up on the back of my neck, and I think, you know, this is perfect. This is perfect for my podcast. So that's how we ended up here, and we're just going to jump right into it, but I do want to let you know that there is a trigger warning. So I will be talking about the murder of a child at some point in today's episode, and if that's not something you want to hear about, I totally understand that. You can fast forward through it. I'll give you a heads up, you know, when we're getting to it. Otherwise, you could just stop the episode and tune in next week, and it will be here for you. So no biggie, no big deal. I want everyone to feel comfortable and, well, as comfortable as you can be. We're listening to true crime here, and we're talking about true crime. But you know what I mean. I don't want anybody triggered or having, like, severe anxiety or stress. No. We don't have time for that. Otherwise, if you're ready, let's just do it. So today's case takes place in Medicine Hat, Canada. It's a pretty unremarkable town, I'm not gonna lie. It's a suburb in the Alberta region, and it's home to many kind and quaint folk. The year is 2006, and I would like to introduce you to the Richardson family. You see, the Richardsons were known to be a happy family, and some describe them as a Norman Rockwell family. And Norman Rockwell, he's a painter who likes to paint, you know, depictions of life in a happy sense, in this great looking aesthetic, I guess you could say. And basically, people thought that the Richardsons had this aesthetic. So we have mom, Deborah, and we have dad, Mark. They were recovering addicts. They had met in a gym, you know, years prior, and they were very happy together. They struggled through their addiction separately, and they had that commonality that they were recovering addicts, and they wanted to get their lives back on track. So they quickly fell for each other. They fell in love, and the rest was history. The whole family could see how much these two loved each other. Then we have 12-year-old Jasmine Richardson and 8-year-old Jacob, all known by the community as a loving family, mind you. They were the type of family that everyone wished to have or to be. And neighbors loved the Richardsons. Their family loved them. Their friends loved them. Hell, everyone loved the Richardsons. What was there not to love? Mark was known to be this bear of a man, this this type of guy who just loved everyone. He was really quiet, but also really sweet. And then there was Deborah, who was just this radiant personality with this large smile. And she was just always happy. Like, some people would say that it was almost like, not fake happy, but almost like, how could you be this happy type of happy? You know what I'm saying? So Mark was a handsome guy, and then Deborah was beautiful, and they had two beautiful kids. Jasmine was gorgeous, Jacob was adorable, and they were living the life. Jasmine was known to be really sweet. She loved her unicorn, she loved the color pink, she was a very girly girl for a good amount of her life. And then there was Jacob, who was just the class clown. He was great in school, teachers loved him, his friends adored him. He had the interests of any 8-year-old boy, but one of the biggest interests was Star Wars. He really loved to pretend to be a Jedi Knight, which is just so adorable because, like, who doesn't love Star Wars? I mean, if you don't, it's totally understandable, but I mean, like, come on, how can you not? It's just so wholesome. So Mark worked as an instrumentation technician in the oil and gas industry, and they actually moved from one region of Canada to Medicine Hat once Mark got a promotion at work. So that's how they ended up in this area of Alberta. And Deborah was working as a cleaning lady. I guess she liked to clean houses and make some side income, but she was hoping to save up enough money to open like a Reiki business. She was very into native spirituality, medicine wheels, dream catchers, and she also practiced Wicca, which her daughter Jasmine ended up taking an interest in as well. And for those of you who don't know what Wicca is, it's a religion influenced by pre-Christian beliefs and practices of Western Europe that affirms the existence of supernatural power, such as magic, and of both male and female deities who inhere in nature, and that emphasizes ritual observance of seasonal and life cycles. It's a pretty peaceful religious practice. And Deborah Richardson was really the type of person who was peaceful, who wanted to promote being a positive person. She really loved her crystals and nature and believed in the Wiccan religion. And for a while, it seemed like her daughter Jasmine sported that as well. And for those of you who don't know what Reiki is, that's a Japanese form of energy healing, which is an alternative type of medicine. Reiki practitioners use a technique called palm healing or hands-on healing, through which a universal energy is said to be transferred through the palms of the practitioner to the patient in order to encourage emotional or physical healing. So really, this just goes to show how nice of a person Deborah Richardson was. She wanted to be a person who could heal others and who could help them get on a path that was more positive. As I mentioned before, Mark and Deborah had met during their recovery from alcoholism, and Deborah would even become a sponsor for other people struggling with alcoholism, and that was all done on her free time. So as you could see, I think I painted a pretty good picture of the Richardson family. They were just wholesome people trying to stay on a good path and lead a good life and provide a supportive household for their children. But by 2006, something changed for the Richardson family. It was Jasmine. The transition from 11 years old to 12 was pretty profound for her. She was an early bloomer, and she seemed to have physically matured way before her peers. So people would commonly mistake Jasmine for a 16-year-old. But she was just 12 years old, okay? People, allow that to sink in, because so many people said that while reading or listening to this case, they kept forgetting that she was 12 because of how mature she looked. And I don't know, just the power she had as a 12-year-old was just a lot, okay? I want you to think back to yourself when you were 12. And I know, I'm sorry. I know we don't want to go there. But honestly and truly, who were you when you were 12, okay? Because I was a little weirdo, strange kid who had skunk hair. Yeah, skunk hair. My hair is brown, but when I was 12, I was so hell-bent on having pink streaks in my hair. Needless to say, I had my hair bleached, and it was just, listen, it turned into a mess. I had white streaks in my hair. I was called skunk hair. I looked like a skunk, a little baby skunk, and not a cute one, but it is what it is. Okay, so 12 was cringy. You couldn't pay me to go back to middle school, I'll tell you that right now. Okay, so Jasmine's 12, people mistook her for 16. 12 and 16, okay, you at 12 and 16 is wildly different, I could imagine. Okay, there's a huge difference there. There was for me. So during that time, from 11 to 12 years old, Jasmine was very active on social media. Social media in 2006 was MySpace, okay? MySpace was huge, so I know if I've got some younger youngings listening to this, MySpace is kind of foreign. You've probably heard of it, but still it's foreign. And, you know, while she was on MySpace, her name or handle, whatever you call it, was X_Madness_X. Okay. She listed her interests as hatchets, serial killers, criminal psychology, blood, human anatomy, and kinky shit. Yeah. That was all like quote unquote. And she was 11 when she wrote this. Okay. And this stayed this way until she was, you know, 12. Her heroes were listed as Jeffrey Dahmer, yes, the cannibal, Batman, Chris Angel, and Marilyn Manson. Okay, so there's quite a few worries, you know, concerns here, because, Jeffrey Dahmer's a cannibal, he ate people, okay, that's first of all. I love Batman, can't say anything about that. Chris Angel, yeah, I don't know, whatever, I'm not trying to hate, but he was a little, I don't know. Whatever. Marilyn Manson, there's a lot of allegations against that man, okay? So I've got some concerns here, all right? All right. She was also active on a website called vampirefreaks.com. Yeah. And there her name was X-KillerKitty-X. She was on a website called Zorpia.com, where her name was Runaway Devil. I don't know too much about Zorpia. So whatever, it's some type of social media. And then she was also on nextopia.com and her name was Runaway Devil as well. And her email was listed as Dying Resurrection. Edgy. As you can see, this kid is, she's just edgy, huh? She's trying to be edgy. Whatever. Everybody goes through, I guess, like their edgy or dark phase. Most people do, I guess. I won't say everyone, most people do. But yeah, so that's Jasmine. And mind you, on social media, she listed herself as a 16-year-old. So people who would talk to her believe she was 16. They didn't even know she was 11 when she started on some of these platforms. And then, you know, even 12, like, it's just not good, okay? This is just not good. So Jasmine would tend to write really cringy stuff in her bios, and I'm not gonna like go word for word because honestly it's just so cringy, but she described herself as being the almighty Jazz and, you know, told people who were viewing her profile to like bow down. She said that she was good at hiding feelings, she doesn't trust easily. She has attempted to write poetry, attempted to draw anime, and, you know, whatever. She would write dark poetry, which, whatever. But also, she would list in her bio that she likes to scare children, which, not okay. Very concerning. She was a Star Wars fan, and it was evident because she said that one of her talents was making Wookiee noises. And oddly enough, she was afraid of llamas, so I guess that was her kryptonite, some llamas. She mentioned that she was a loud, hyper person, and she bounced around a lot, like jumping up and down. And she listed that other people live inside her head. Yeah, other people live in my head with me. Again, I've got some concerns here. She also listed that she watches Teen Titans, she plays guitar but sucks at it, and she posted a lot about Edgar Allan Poe, his poetry, his writing, his stories, his quotes, and mentioned that she enjoys the bands Cradle of Death and Slipknot, and there were some other bands listed as well. But yeah, this is the gist you're getting of this 12-year-old, okay? She's like trying to be an edgelord, and trying to appear older than she is on social media. So I think you had to be 16 to have a MySpace anyway. I could be wrong. So, you know, I guess that was just to get on MySpace. But regardless, this is the mind of Jasmine from 11 years old to 12 years old, like in that age range. So basically what I picked up from these bios of hers was that she was kind of like wanting to be this person who was like super confident and like, you know, I'm so amazing, bow down to me, like I'm so great. But also I'm going to let you know that I suck. I suck at guitar. I am like an amateur poetry and anime like creator and not necessarily great at it. But I'm also into child kid stuff like Teen Titans, which I still love Teen Titans myself. But you get the gist. And, you know, just loving murderers and listing them as your heroes is not okay. But whatever. This is the picture I am painting of Jasmine for you. So around this time, Jasmine also found herself a new friend group. At school, she had very nice friends. She went to a private school. They were all very reserved and, you know, well-behaved. Jasmine was for a while, and she had excellent grades, very smart girl. And she began hanging out with other kids outside of school. She met them at the mall, and some of these kids were a bit of a mess. They were characterized as the goth group, which is fine. Like, you can be goth and into all black and all that, and that's fine, whatever. But deeper than that, when you peel back the layers of who was in this specific group, there were kids who were you know, acting out, they were delinquent, they weren't going to school, some of them had dropped out of school, some of them were teenage runaways, which, you know, of course, all of this has to do with, like, socioeconomic status and all this other stuff, family background and family homes, what have you. I'm not saying they were bad people, but, you know, they were characterized as the bad kids by locals. So she was kind of getting mixed up in, let's say, the wrong crowd. So Jasmine went from being super girly, loving those unicorns, to loving the color black and punk rock music. This shift in her was quick. It was literally over the span of a few months, like drastically changed. It's not like it was a short evolution. It was like, we're going 0 to 100 and we're going fast. Okay. So this would be fine, but, you know, just because of how quickly it happened, this should have raised red flags to her parents. But, you know, like, no parent is perfect. Everybody makes mistakes, and sometimes we just don't see the signs. But I mentioned it in last week's episode as well, and I'm going to mention it here. If there is a quick shift in your child, like a jump from 0 to 100 in a very short amount of time, this is a cause for a concern, okay? Because here, Jasmine's parents would think that maybe she was just going through a phase. They were actually very supportive of her, you know, change of hats, let's say, which is great and accepting, and that's awesome. But it was super drastic. Her attitude change just tanked quickly. And parents, if you see this in your kids, you know, start to ask questions. I'm not saying be like that overbearing, crazy helicopter parent, but definitely start to, you know, just question things and question your kid. Try to find out what's going on in their life just to make sure they're okay. You know, and I can at least say I have some background in this information. I'm not a parent, but, you know, I am in the mental health field. So we see this sometimes. Like, these exchange shifts usually mean that something in their life is shifting. So anyway, back to the story. So she was changing in more ways than one. It wasn't just her clothing or, like, just her attitude. Like, her attitude was definitely snotty and characteristic of a teenager, but, like, it was getting worse and worse and quickly. So she went from being very respectful to disrespectful. She went from being kind-hearted to a very hardened person. She was angry all of the time, and she was lashing out at friends, at teachers. Teachers were actually the first to notice this shift and, you know, wave the red flag, like, themselves. Like, they contacted Jasmine's parents because she was coming to school in fishnet stockings and very short skirts, and she was wearing, like, these chains around her neck, chokers. She was being very sexually provocative, and, you know, I don't really care what people wear, honestly, but when you are enrolled in a private school and you have to wear a uniform, it's just kind of what you have to do. I understand a bit of rebellion, but this was, like, starting to go past rebellion. Like, she, by the time we get to, like, the thick of this story, into the thick of it, sorry, that's a TikTok trigger right there. By the time we get into the thick of this story, she will have a huge folder at school. Okay. And this was just in a few months. So like, I want you to understand like kind of how drastic this change was. Her friends were very perplexed, honestly, and they knew that she had met someone, and we'll get to that in a second, but she did meet a man. I was going to say a boy, but it was a whole man. She met a man through her friends at the mall, and some, you know, sometimes, like, while researching, I heard that she met oh my God, I'm having, like, a problem. People said she met this man at punk rock shows, but I also saw that she met him at the mall. So I couldn't get a definitive answer there. It was kind of varied. So this is kind of more from word of mouth. You can't really get too much from the court documents. But anyway, they met. That's all you need to know. But her friends knew that they met him. She met him, and they weren't too happy about it because of his character. But she was changing, and the kids at school were actually even becoming afraid of her. Yeah. She was coming to school with, like, satanic markings on her. She would draw on her for Sharpie. So I'm sure this was, like, shock factor, but I also, I'm not sure based on, like, how this story turns. I'm really not sure if it was shock factor or if she really, like, meant it. But anyway, it's not okay to be disrespectful and just like disobey authority at school. Sorry, I'm going to be that person. I mean, I had my share of getting in trouble in school, but like not to the extent that Jasmine had. So they rang the alarm bells to mom and mom and dad were just like, well, is she hurting anyone? And at the time they were like, no. And they were like, okay, well, she's just expressing herself. Okay, well, regardless, Mr. and Mrs. Richardson, you pay a, you know, a good amount of money to go to this private school, and your kid's got to wear the uniform. You know what I'm saying? So whatever. Then things would kick it up a notch when her parents would start cracking down on her. So whatever. We'll get to that. I said whatever a lot in this episode. I think the teen angst is rubbing off on me. I'm not going to lie. So eventually, Mark and Deborah Richardson would start cracking down on their kid. And basically, this happened when they went out one night and Jasmine was supposed to babysit her 8-year-old brother, Jacob. And they were out having their good time and whatnot when they get a phone call from Jacob, and he's very upset. He's very worried because Jasmine left him home alone and decided to go out with her friends instead of watching him. So he was very scared by himself, and he called his parents asking them to come home, and mom and pop were not happy. Okay. They were very angry. She had never done this before. So, you know, they had been very lenient with her. They've been very understanding up until this point, but this was too much. So the Richardsons raced home, and they found out that Jasmine had snuck out to be with her friends, and this got her grounded, and her cell phone privileges were taken away, her phone privileges in general, like the landline. She wasn't allowed to go on the computer either. She wasn't allowed to hang out with her friends. She was only allowed to leave to go to school. So this was like a drastic crackdown from her parents. You know, she wasn't used to this. So, of course, the rebellion was rough, okay? She was pissed. And, you know, that could happen. You go from having very lenient or passive parents to, you know, I guess they just had enough and they cracked down, like, fully and hard. That's when you're going to get a lot of pushback. But whatever, this isn't a parenting class, okay? We're talking true crime. So the Richardsons are becoming concerned now. They're like, all right, maybe, you know, we should have been, like, on this earlier. They were just perplexed because they didn't understand how Jasmine had become a person who did not care about other people's feelings, specifically her brother's, and they were just fed up with the acting out, you know, because as she's grounded, she's just getting worse. She's being more of a jerk. The provocative and inappropriate behavior was getting worse, and they knew that Jasmine fell into a crowd at the mall, you know, of friends that they weren't happy about. So they knew if they pressed her too hard that she was probably going to rebel even more. So they were kind of at that standstill at this point. So what were they supposed to do? Well, Back at school, Jasmine pretty much lost all of her friends. They didn't like her behavior. They didn't recognize this new version of Jasmine. And like I mentioned, some of the kids at school were very fearful of her because of the things that she would say out loud and the things she would do. So her parents decided that if they were not going to get answers from Jasmine, they had to go get the answers from somewhere else because they were trying to talk to her and it just wasn't working. So they began looking through her phone and on the computer, and whoa, the things they found on there. So, you know, they found her MySpace specifically, and they saw these pictures that she was posing in, and they were like risque photos. They saw the inappropriate things that she was writing. They saw who her listed heroes were, and so on and so forth. And they found that she was using these other websites and that she had been talking to a 23-year-old man. And one more thing I just want to mention. Jasmine had become like so fed up with her parents' rules that she actually went to her guidance counselor and told her guidance counselor that she wanted to go into foster care because she didn't want to be with her parents anymore. And the guidance counselor was like, wait, pump the brakes accordingly. What do you mean? Like, are you being abused? Are you being physically hurt? Like, whatever. Emotionally hurt. And she was just like, no, I just can't stand them and just the rules they put on me. So, like, the guidance counselors were just like, oh, Lord, this girl. And this was made known to the Richardsons that she had made this statement. And I'm wondering, like, of course, half it was because she didn't want anyone to tell her what to do. But I also can't help but wonder if it was because of the crowd of people she was involved with. Like one of her friends that I'll mention a little bit later, she was that teen runaway who would run away from her foster homes and everything. I wonder if like Jasmine was just trying to fit in with these kids because she felt she didn't fit in anywhere else. And she was really trying to take on the same persona, like that bad girl, like, I don't know, foster home type role so she can just relate more. It sounds like she was having a really tough time. And this crowd of kids she was hanging out with, you know, they were boys, girls, what have you, and they ranged from 13 to 24 years old. So there was a huge mix of people here. So she was really trying to find a place where she fit in. So once the Richardsons looked at these messages that were being sent back and forth between 12-year-old Jasmine, 12 years old, to 23-year-old Jeremy Steinke, they had a lot of questions and, you know, things were not good. So who was this 23-year-old man? And why was he sending messages that were sexual in nature to their daughter? They were having like a sexual relationship, like they were like almost sexting, I guess, and they were meeting and having sex and they were dating, like they were in a relationship. This was not good. And you know, prior to this happening, it's ironic because the Richardsons ended up taking Jasmine to a punk rock show, and it was because she wanted to go with her friends, and at the time she was grounded and her parents like felt bad, I guess. So they said, okay, you can go on one condition. We're going to come with you. And, you know, Jasmine was like, okay, cool. So they went and she was able to sneak away from them. And they realized that she wasn't coming back from wherever she said she was going. And when they went to go find her, they actually found her outside of this punk rock venue making out with a man. And it turned out that that would be Jeremy Steinke. So the parents had kind of witnessed this happen, but didn't know who the guy was. They thought he was just some random dude. But also, like, another tidbit, like, once you put the hammer down on your kids, you can't, like, loosen up and go lenient on them. And, you know, they went lenient pretty quickly. Like, they went from being, like, tightrope to quickly releasing. Like, you can't do that. You kind of have to maintain it for a little bit before you can loosen up. But whatever. So this is all just for you to understand how things happen and like how things kind of like, I guess, you know, went on a downward spiral pretty quickly. So anyway, Jeremy Steinke, he was viewed as an odd duck by his peers, and he had been bullied relentlessly throughout his life in school. And he had a really, really terrible home life. And his mom was an alcoholic who constantly dated abusive men. Jeremy's father was abusive. They would end up separating. And then, you know, his mother would remarry. And that guy was just as bad, just as abusive. And it was just a nightmare. They were constantly uprooted. So he went to multiple schools and didn't have a chance to really make friends. And his siblings were abused too. So Jeremy became a high school dropout. He lived in a trailer park. So this was a really just sad upbringing. He had made a suicide attempt before meeting Jasmine. And he went around claiming to his friends and people around that he was a 300-year-old werewolf. He wore a necklace with a vial of blood around his neck. Nobody really knows whose blood it was, if it was his or someone else's, but he like truly believed he was a werewolf and in the Lycan Brotherhood. And if you don't know what a Lycan is, that's just like werewolf like bloodline, you know. If you watch like Resident Evil or whatever horror movies, chances are you'll hear about it. But he truly believed he was a werewolf. I don't understand. But okay. So he would end up giving Jasmine a vial of his own blood, and she believed that he was a werewolf. So he was hellbent on the idea that his Lycan empire would one day rise up and that him and Jasmine would go get a castle in Germany together. So yeah. And Jeremy would threaten people, like if anybody, like as he got older, would mess with him, he would tell them to be careful because he eats people and kills people. Like that's what he would say. So this is just the type of guy that he was. He wore all black, had all black makeup. He wasn't always like in the goth scene. I think he actually got into the goth scene around 21, 22 from what I've read. So it really wasn't that long because he met Jasmine when he was 23. But basically his childhood was really sucky. When his biological father would come home from work, he'd be drunk. Or if he would just come home from anywhere, he'd be drunk. And he would whip Jeremy with his belt. He would drag him by his ears from room to room. Then once his mom got remarried to his stepdad, that guy, like I said, was a drunk too. He would take paint sticks and slap the kids on the hands if he thought that they were lying. And he would slap them on the hands until they told the truth. He tied them up to chairs and had them watch each other get beat by him. So really, really horrible situation here. And one of his, actually his stepfather, the second marriage, that guy stuck Jeremy's head in a deep freezer and punched him in the head repeatedly and in his face. So that all happened because he was trying to protect his mom, who was being beat by the stepfather. So Jeremy had a horrible childhood. He was abused. He was hit in the head multiple times, which is really important to note. It was just not a good life for Jeremy, plus all the bullying at school. So the kid was really messed up, okay? And not to mention all the uprooting, the moving, possibly losing their home, all of that fear, like, manifests. And this is like how you get a killer. Like this is part of the recipe. And I'm not saying everybody's going to turn out this way, because I mean like his siblings didn't, but like you've got very specific things that happened to him and it could equate to a killer. So this is how stuff like this gets formed. It's part of a recipe. Like that's how I put it anyway, from my understanding. But Jeremy really didn't have a set of friends, like a set group of friends, until he met this group at the mall. And once he got involved with this group, they loved him. He was really popular, and it was the first time in his life people ever like wanted to be around him this much. And that's probably because a lot of the kids were younger. He also dated underage girls. He got a 16-year-old pregnant. And that was before Jasmine. I don't know if that girl kept the baby, but I do know that he did, in fact, get her pregnant. Yeah, he had a thing for younger girls. Everybody knew it. It's disturbing. It's really disturbing. And, you know, I think back to being in high school. Back to middle school. And I remember this one girl. Still remember her to this day. And we were like 12 or 13. And she was dating a 21-year-old. And to me, I was disturbed, and he was very emotionally and verbally abusive to her. And I just remember telling her that it wasn't normal for a 21-year-old to be dating her, and that had to be like pedophilia, But I remember her getting really mad at me and we didn't speak for months. It actually kind of tarnished our relationship. So also while doing research and on Reddit forums and listening to other people who told this case, it's surprising because many people mentioned that they had the same experience as younger females. They remember hearing about that one girl in school who had like a really old boyfriend. So it's kind of, not kind of, it is disturbing because this is like, this is predator behavior. Like that is pedophilia. You cannot be a man or a woman engaging in sexual relations with a child. A 12-year-old is a child, okay? A 13-year-old is a child, and, you know, whatever. That's just the way it is. But it was disturbing to hear how many people have been through similar experiences. So I had to mention that and throw that in there. So yeah, many people like Jeremy because he was older, he had a car, he could get booze, all that stuff, drugs, what have you. His elementary school went on to describe him as a very angry and unstable person. Other people mentioned that he would drop acid, he would do shrooms, he drank a lot, he smoked a lot of marijuana. There was just a lot of stuff in the mix here. And on top of this, he did have a diagnosis of ADHD, so that's just interesting to know. And one time he was 15, when he was 15 years old, he got drunk and passed out in the snow and got hypothermia. So this was just Jeremy, man. He was a bit of a mess, and like his elementary school teacher described him, he was unstable. It's easy to see why, though. He became a cutter, so he would self-harm. He fought people constantly because he was being bullied, and he dropped out of high school 3 months into 10th grade. And then after that, he would get dead-end jobs, he would stay with friends and couch surf, and eventually he would go back to medicine, well, not back to, but he would attend Medicine Hat College, where he would try to go back to get his high school credits that he'd never got, but he would end up dropping out. And then he would return home with mom, which had to be a disaster. And she actually got she got arrested for stabbing one of her boyfriends. So yeah, it was a mess. But in that communication between Jasmine and Jeremy, it was, again, as I'm sure you can imagine, cringy. They were just like calling each other like pet names, but also talking about killing people. Like he'd say, "I can't wait to kill with you, baby." Like, you know, like stuff like this, like talking about some really, really dark and twisted stuff. So, of course, Mark and Deborah were appalled. They were enraged by these communications, and they told Jasmine that she was forbidden from seeing Jeremy, which I have to say, they are much nicer than me because my ass would have been on the phone calling the cops to ensure that they were absolutely separated and, you know, legally he was not allowed to see her. But alas, Deborah and Mark did not get the authorities involved. I guess, I don't know, they must have felt for the guy, or they didn't want to ruin his life or something. Me, on the other hand, I would have been like, no, you're 23 years old and you're sexually involved with my 12-year-old. I'm calling the cops. But whatever, they didn't do that. They just forbid their daughter from seeing him, which, come on, mom and dad, is that really gonna work? If there's a will, there's a way. So instead, they just took her internet privileges away and her phone privileges away. And of course, they grounded her again. And she wasn't allowed to leave the house unless it was for school. But they were going to be sure of it. They were really watching her and monitoring her. And well, kids, like I said, when there's a will, there's a way. Because Jasmine would continue communicating with Jeremy through school computers. And they were still writing messages to each other. They talked about killing people still. They were talking about being crazy or being psycho, and they would gush over the film Natural Born Killers, which is all about a couple who kills the girl's family by cutting their throats due to an abusive environment that she's in. So just remember that, because that's important. That was their whole like romance movie. Like for some people, they love The Notebook as a couple. For these people, they love Natural Born Killers. Okay, so yeah. So one day, Jasmine had enough from being kept from Jeremy, so she sent him a message, and the message states, "I have a plan. It involves me killing them and us being together forever." So she had told him, that's it, like, it's time to kill them. And he was talking about how they needed to discuss the details and really, like, think about this and maybe move forward with it. So eventually they would talk about it, and the idea was that Jeremy was gonna kill the parents. And, you know, at first they weren't gonna kill the little brother. So we are gonna be diving into the actual details of what happens next. So if this is not what you want to hear, you might want to skip. So as the two were kept apart, you know, things started getting worse and worse. They were just angrier from being kept apart. So one quote from Jeremy goes like this: "It's all total bullshit. Their throats I want to slit. They will regret the shit they have done, especially when I see to it that they are gone. They shall pay for their insolence. Finally, there shall be silence. Their blood shall be payment." And Jasmine goaded him. She really wanted this. She wanted her parents dead. And he was starting to give in to this idea of killing them. At one point, Jeremy even tried to encourage a friend to help him kill Jasmine's parents. And the friend, like, wasn't taking him seriously. They were doing drugs together, and he was like, yeah, okay, guy, I'm not doing that. I'm not cut out for murder. But no. But nobody thought that he was really going to do it. Apparently, he had talked about it to other people as well, and nobody, like, called the police or notified authorities or anything, because, again, most of the time they were all doing drugs, and also they just didn't believe him that he was going to do it. But Jeremy always talked about bloodlust and loving blood and being a werewolf, but also being on vampires.com or whatever, vampirefreaks.com. So it's like, are you a werewolf or are you a vampire? Like, what? Like, people, who knows? People were just like, whatever, this guy's a little crazy. He's talking about killing a lot, but we're not going to report it. And Jasmine was also talking to her friends about it. She was talking to her friends about how angry she was that she was grounded and how she wanted to kill her parents and she wanted them dead. But again, nobody took her seriously. Not that they were doing drugs together, but they were just like, okay, it's Jasmine. We can't imagine her ever killing her parents. So nobody reported it. So on the night of April 22nd, 2006, is when the Richardsons were murdered. So basically, everybody was home. The next door neighbor named Gareth, he was also a little boy. He was best friends with Jacob. He was actually supposed to sleep over, but those plans got canceled when his grandma surprised him with hockey game tickets. So he did not spend the night. So everybody was home. Jasmine took a bath. She was relaxing, and she had something planned that her family could never have imagined. And as the night is turning down, Deborah hears some commotion downstairs. She doesn't know what it is. She thinks maybe it's her daughter sneaking out. That's what it sounds like. So she goes downstairs in her robe to see what's going on. And there is Jeremy standing in the house wearing a neoprene mask, which, if you don't know what that is, it's like one of those masks that cover half of your face. And it was all black. He was wearing all black. And prior to getting there, he did so many hard drugs and was drinking so much alcohol. It's surprising that he was even able to stand up, because I guess he needed to do this to prep for the murder, to be able to kill somebody. And he had watched Natural Born Killers on repeat. So he was all hopped up on drugs and alcohol, and he decided to start stabbing Deborah Richardson repeatedly over and over again. And she was screaming. Mark Richardson would hear the screams of his wife, and he would grab a screwdriver and run downstairs. And he was just wearing his boxers, but he didn't care. He needed to go help his wife. So he ran downstairs and saw that there was a man on top of his wife stabbing her over and over again. He jumped on him and started trying to stab the guy with the screwdriver. And I don't think at first he, like, really realized it was Jeremy, but Jeremy ended up getting the upper hand and was able to stab Mark. And at one point he had Mark on the ground, and Mark was like, why are you doing this? And I don't have an exact quote, because the quotes change depending on who reported on the case, but basically Jeremy responded, because you treat your kid like shit and she wants it this way. or you treat your daughter like shit and she wants this way, wants it this way. So the last words Mark Richardson heard were from a murderer who said that his daughter wanted this done. So if you can only imagine how hurtful it must have been, how hurtful it must have been to hear those words, to not be able to help your wife, and to know your 8-year-old son is upstairs. Like, that had to be horrifying. So at this point, while this is all going on, Jasmine ran into Jacob's room and he was really scared. From hearing what was going down, you know, or going on downstairs of the home. And she was like telling him it was okay. And she actually stabbed him once in the chest. And oh, it's horrible. Had him on his bed, told him to go to sleep. And she took her arm and started squeezing around his neck to make him pass out. Because in her head, I guess she thought if she made him pass out, he wouldn't be in as much pain when killing him. But Jacob was a fighter and was trying to fight her off of him. And he was only 68 pounds, mind you, and couldn't really fight his sister off too much, was able to get out of her grip, though. And Jeremy came up the stairs, and of course, Jacob was terrified, and Jasmine would end up slitting her little brother's throat deeply, like a deep wound was in his throat. And he tried fighting for his life. And experts would later say that there was so much blood in the hallway, so it's more than likely evident that maybe he got stabbed in the hallway first and then his throat was slit while he was on the bed. Or maybe he tried getting out of the room and his throat was slit and so he was bleeding everywhere in the hallway. But also there was blood on his little lightsaber, and it is thought that he had tried fighting off the two of them with his lightsaber. So it just really, really awful. And then after that, Jeremy said, I have to go outside. I need some air. He went outside and he was panicking. He was losing it. He just murdered two people and watched his girlfriend viciously murder her little brother. And he left. He actually got in his car and drove to his trailer and left her there. But that wasn't it for Jasmine. Jasmine called a cab and she packed a bag. She got in the cab and went to Jeremy's trailer. And when she got there, he was just like, we need to go. We need to get out of town now. Like, this is not good. But instead, they would end up going to a party. Once they got to the party, people would recall them being happy, laughing all over each other. Jasmine was like mounting him while he was on the couch. They would end up having sex. Like, literally no regard for what just happened at all whatsoever. And then it was even said that they started bragging about it while at the party, that they had killed Jasmine's family. And Jasmine was laughing about it and even said that her brother was gurgling. Okay? Like, this is depraved shit. This is disgusting. I don't know. I just don't know what 12-year-old does this and what 23-year-old could do this. So it's just so disturbing. But needless to say, one of their friends, Casey Lancaster, was going somewhere. They were traveling, her and some other friends, and they would end up inviting Jeremy and Jasmine with them. And a lot of the friends said that they had no idea about the murder, you know, and with them gloating about it, they just didn't take them seriously and didn't think that they actually did it. So I don't know. Like, a lot of this story is BS, in my opinion, going forward. But basically, they would all end up going on this little trip together, and it would end up falling apart for them. But we'll get to that. At 1 p.m. the next day, the Richardson family would be discovered. If you remember that little boy that lived next door that was supposed to sleep over, Gareth, I mentioned him before. It would be the next day, and he would notice that Mark Richardson's pickup truck was in the driveway, and he got excited and wanted to go see Jacob. So he asked his mom if he could go over and ask Jacob to play. And she said, yeah, of course, like no problem. So Jacob ran next door and he knocked on the door, but nobody answered. And he thought that was weird because they always answered. So he knocked again and he waited, nothing, waited, nothing. So he decided to start investigating. So with the way the Richardson house was, it was like a split level home. So it's weird. Like if you look through the ground level window, it looked like into a basement almost. And I have a picture up on crimeghoul_. That's my handle for Instagram if you want to check it out so you could get a better visual. But he would look in that window and he would see two bodies, and they were covered in blood, and there was blood on the wall by the stairs, and he freaked out. Oh, there's Kylo talking again. As you can tell, Kylo's not too happy about this, and he also wants to go outside. But Gareth would run back home to his mom, and he would say, "Mommy, there's bodies at the Richardson's house." And she was just like, "I'm sorry, what?" And she went over there and she looked through the window for herself, and there she would see what turned out to be Mark laying on the ground, like on his back, and his hands were like in a boxer stance, like as if he was getting ready to fight. Like his fists were balled up and everything. And then she could see half of what would be Deborah's body, and it was covered in blood. So she immediately called 911, and the police got there and they searched the house, and they were told that the Richardsons also have a 12-year-old daughter and she was nowhere to be found. So at first they thought she was a kidnapped person. So it went out as an Amber Alert that she was missing. So her name wasn't supposed to be released to the public, but because it was like an Amber Alert, it was. But of course, she wasn't a kidnapped child. So police wouldn't find Jasmine until the next day. So the day after her parents were discovered killed. And they were on tow on their little adventure with their friends when they stopped at a gas station. And mind you, one officer was so smart. He was kind of like new to the whole like scene, this department and everything. And, you know, when he heard about the situation, and they started to figure things out and put two and two together very quickly that she was not a victim and that she was likely one of the killers, based off of the stuff they found online, he had this idea and was like, okay, if they're going to try to leave town, they're probably going to need gas. And this is probably the gas station they're going to go to. It's the biggest one. It's got the most stuff, the most convenience, like food, all that stuff. So if I had to put my money on it, I bet this is where they're going to be. So he stayed there for hours. And finally, a car pulls up and a bunch of teenagers get out of it. And what do you have it? It's Jasmine and her little friends. So they're going in like the gas station, and one of their friends actually picks up a newspaper that has Jasmine's face on it. And, you know, it's talking about like how these two people are, well, she's definitely wanted for like the murder of her family and whatever. And they're like, "Jasmine, is this you?" And she starts like laughing about it. And Jeremy's like, "Oh, that doesn't even look like you." But meanwhile, it's literally one of her school photos that was on the paper. Like, embarrassing. Anyway, they're just like, "Yeah, no, I don't know what that is." And for whatever reason, the friend's just like, "Eh, okay. Yeah, sure." And, you know, Casey, the friend I mentioned, she has to know what's going on, considering she also helped Jeremy clean the car. His car that was covered in blood. So the day before, she helped him clean it, and he said he had a black eye because he got into a fight and somebody like really beat him up bad, and that's why there was blood all over the car. Meanwhile, they were telling everybody that they killed Jasmine's family. So Casey definitely knew what was up, and it's actually rumored that Casey was like in love with Jeremy for a long time, but that's not here nor there. Anyway, Casey Lancaster was involved with this situation. So that's just some information for you to have. But nonetheless, the officer approaches the teens and they're all booked pretty quickly. So they're all being like arrested for the murder of the Richardson family. And the kids go buck wild, okay? They're in the police car and they separate the girls from the boys. And the girls are just a nightmare in the patrol car. And Casey ends up like kicking the plexiglass window out that separates you from the officer. They're like shouting all of these horrible things to the cops and that they're going to kill the cops. They're tearing up the leather seats with their like whatever they have with them. Like, it's just awful. Like, they're just acting atrocious. So they would end up being booked into a county jail. And that's where the truth really started to come out, and the focus comes back to Jeremy and Jasmine. And at first, one of the detectives has Jasmine, you know, in an interrogation room, and he's using like the whole like dad complex to try to get information out of her. But instead, this just makes her cry like uncontrollably, like they're not getting any information out of her. So they have to think of a new tactic. And that newer like officer or whatever he is decides that he's going to go in with more of like a peer, like, I guess, persona or complex or approach. That's the word I'm looking for, a peer approach. So he goes inside the room and he just starts like picking on Jasmine, like in a funny way, like, oh, you write your S's really weird, as she's like writing on something. And she falls for it immediately, and she starts getting like goo goo gaga over him, which is just also disturbing. And she's like, I like you, you smell good, like, okay, Jasmine, you're a weirdo, but whatever, that's what she's concerned about. But anyway, this guy is good. He knows what he's doing. And this had never been done before over there. So this was like some groundbreaking stuff. But he said to Jasmine, you know, I think you should like write a letter to your parents apologizing. And she ends up doing it. She falls for it. And it acts as a confession. So that worked out really well. And she kind of writes what happened in a sense. So she's pinning everything on Jeremy at this point, though. And the cops are hearing something completely different from Jeremy. They're hearing that he's admitting to killing the parents, but that Jasmine killed Jacob. Which Jasmine's just pinning everything on Jeremy and stating that she was just too scared to do anything and whatever. So obviously the cops aren't buying this. They're like, this is BS. Like, there's no way like you would stay with this guy or not try to get away or like do all these things you did. And they're admitting to things like having sex afterwards, like whatever. They hear from witnesses, all this stuff. So 2 and 2 are not adding up, of course. So they go to Jeremy and they're like, you know, she's saying that you killed all three of them. And he flips out. He's just like, what? No, she slit his throat. She slit his throat, is like repeating it, like really annoyed. So they obviously have a pretty good idea that his reaction is real. And they believe that she did kill her brother. So that one officer, the one who acted like the peer, suggests like he could start passing notes like between Jasmine and Jeremy. So he's like, do you want to write a note to Jeremy? I could get it to him if you want. And like, this was just a great tactic because she falls for it and she just starts writing some cringy stuff like, oh, don't worry, my love, don't be fearful, what's done is done, like, you know, all this stuff about how I love you, blah, 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 blah. And then Jeremy's like writing the same gushy stuff back and forth. Like, I can't wait to get out of here and get our castle, which like, bitch, you're not going anywhere. Okay. And yeah, so the cops really used a lot of tactics to get confessions out of Jeremy and Jasmine. And with Jeremy, one person would dress up like as a convict or whatever. And he was really an undercover cop that would end up getting information from Jeremy. And this happened in prison as well, once he goes to prison, like getting more information. So yeah, like his story remained the same. Like, I killed the parents, she killed her little brother, and was talking about like how he gurgled and she was laughing about it. And Jeremy was shocked that her demeanor was so poised and she didn't seem to really care. She wasn't fazed after it happened. Meanwhile, he was like having a bit of a panic attack and had to go home and left her. So there's just a lot of craziness here, you know, like that's the best way I can put it. It's just disturbing beyond belief. So then, of course, the trials would all happen and we'd go through the whole court procedure and whatnot. And they would ask her, as in Jasmine, like, why did you do this? And, you know, oh, I didn't mean to do it. This just went too far. He took my word seriously. I was kidding all of those times. And, you know, her friends were testifying against her, like, you know, saying, yeah, no, this is like what happened. And she would always talk about wanting to kill her parents. And a lot of like her friends broke down while they were on the stand, because who wants to be that person who didn't think that her friend was really going to kill her parents and then did, like, you know? Or who wants to have a friend who ends up being a murderer? Like, nobody. And they all knew her family. So it's just so disturbing. And to know what happened to Jacob, like, all of it, it's just, it's heart-wrenching, to be quite honest. So Jasmine was heavily questioned while in court. And they were like, you didn't think to call the cops when Jeremy was stabbing your mom? You didn't think to call the cops when Jeremy was stabbing your dad? And then you're saying that he's the one who killed your brother and you didn't think to call the cops? She's like, no. Okay, you didn't think to run away and go to a neighbor and call the cops? No. Like, all of this stuff. Like, she's just claiming it was all him, which obviously, based on everything, like, she was really the one who was goading him to kill her parents. Like, through all of the communications, it's evident. And he just wants to please her. Like, he's in love with her. And for him, I think it was love. For her, I don't think so. She was only 12 years old. I don't think you could really have a conception of loving a 23-year-old man. But for him, I think he really did love her. But he's a pedophile. Sorry. Like, that's it. You're a pedophile. But as you can see, Jeremy was very immature, whereas Jasmine was more mature. So it's weird how they ended up, like, meeting somewhere in the middle, because it was catastrophic. It's not like this obviously worked out in any way. And it turned into this tragic disaster. So for the sentencing phase, Jeremy would be found guilty by the jury on 3 counts of first-degree murder for the killings of Deborah, Mark, and Jacob. On December 15th, 2008, Steinke was sentenced to those 3 life sentences, one for each first-degree murder count. And the sentences were to be served concurrently, so back-to-back, and Steinke would be eligible for parole after serving 25 years. And again, this is just the Canadian law system. This is how it works over there. So he actually would have the eligibility for parole, which is interesting. You know, obviously, I have my beliefs, but this is just how the law works over there. And then for Jasmine, under the Youth Criminal Justice Act, Jasmine could not have her name published in, like, Canada. Like, nowhere in Canada could they publish her name because she was a minor. But the irony is that her name was already out there because they thought she was a kidnapped child. So that's how her name literally got plastered everywhere around Canada. But under the same act, 12 is the youngest age at which a person can be charged with a crime. And convicts under 14 years of age at the time they committed a crime could not be sentenced as adults and could not be given more than a 10-year sentence. So that's right, kids. On July 9th, 2007, Jasmine, who was 13 by the time, was found guilty of 3 counts of first-degree murder in the killings. And she was believed to be the youngest person ever convicted of multiple murder in Canada. On November 8th, 2007, she was sentenced to the maximum allowed under law for someone her age, and that was 10 years imprisonment. Her sentence included credit for the 18 months that she already served in custody, and that was going to be followed by 4 years in a psychiatric institution and 4.5 years under conditional supervision in the community. So not even in, like, a prison or correctional facility. So, of course, this is so controversial for people, and I can completely understand why, because she slit her 8-year-old brother's throat and was only going to get 10 years, and 5 of those years would be in a psychiatric institution. But Canada does heavily believe in rehabilitation and being able to rehabilitate offenders. So, I mean, I don't know. I still don't know how I feel about that. I think it's so hard to trust a person. And somebody who's capable of going to those lengths, it's like you have to reach a really dark, deep corner of your brain that most people don't even have the capability of going to. So how can you come back from that? I don't know. That's the question. So in September of 2011, Jasmine began attending classes at Mount Royal University in Calgary, and people were talking, okay? Everybody knew who she was. So it couldn't have been an easy time for her. I wish I knew more. If anybody knows or went to school with Jasmine, I would love to hear from you, and I could keep you anonymous, but I am just so curious. And like, I don't have to like post about it or share about it, but I think it would be really interesting to get an idea of how this rehabilitation has contributed to Jasmine in a public setting, if that makes sense. So, yeah, she was attending university in those final years of her sentence, not in prison. She was just under supervision. So, she was released from the 10-year sentence at the psychiatric hospital in the fall of 2011. And in October 2012, it was reported her rehabilitation was going very well. And she was expressing remorse for her actions, and experts considered it to be genuine. I don't know. I haven't found any evidence of like her actually showing remorse. It's really hard because in Canada, you're not gonna find any film or anything of her because she was a minor at the time. But it gets a little crazier because in May of 2016, her sentence was completed and she was freed of any further court-ordered conditions, restrictions, or supervision. So after like 5 years after that, if she was not involved in, the criminal world in any way and wasn't charged with any type of criminal offenses, her record would be expunged. So her record was expunged, and she has since changed her name. So that means she can work wherever the hell she wants. She could be whoever the hell she wants. She could work in a daycare. She can work with children, even though she slit her little brother's throat while he fought for his life. So I just want you to think about that. And I want to believe in rehabilitation. I truly do. But you just never know. How could you ever be certain? But from what I've read, there are people online who claim to know Jasmine. Who knows how seriously you could take it? It's the internet. I take it with a grain of salt, if that. It might even be smaller than that. But they say that Jasmine is a really lovely person and she is sick every day based off of what she did, and all this hoo-ha that I really, quite frankly, don't want to hear because you killed your family. Okay? There will never be sympathy. The only thing I could sympathize with maybe is the fact that she was groomed by a 23-year-old, because in my opinion, she was. There's no way she wasn't. And she was, in my opinion, sexually abused by a man because there's no way she could be able to give consent to a 23-year-old man at 12. That's just how I look at it. Everybody's got their opinions, but I can definitely maybe sympathize and empathize with her for that. As for Jeremy, he's still in prison and he has since changed his name to what the heck is it? Jackson May. That's right. To Jackson May. I don't know too much more about him besides the fact that, people have come forward saying that in prison he swears that Jasmine did slit his like her brother's throat and everything, but he takes full responsibility for what he did. Not that that really matters. It's just you killed three people. Like, oh, like I can't. And, like I said, with his upbringing, it was horrible. And I could empathize with his upbringing being horrible, but I can't go past that. This is a way to understand what happened, but not in any way to give it an excuse. Also, experts would say that Jeremy was a product of fetal alcohol syndrome based on his facial characteristics. So it's really heavily believed that, he has fetal alcohol syndrome. So all of this, with all the head injuries, with all of the abuse, with all of the uprooting, with all of the bullying, everything, it's kind of not understandable, but I can put it together in my head and I could wrap my head around how this could possibly create a killer. And then there's Jasmine, who wasn't abused in any way. The only thing that really had to be hard for her, in my opinion, and I don't know everything that happened to this girl, so there's that, and I'm totally aware of that. But the only thing that we know that could be really hard for her was the fact that she developed physically earlier than her peers. And, you know, she was very smart, so maybe she even matured in that way much faster than her peers, which could be very difficult, especially as a teen girl. It's hard. And, you know, when you mature quicker, this could lead to aggression, depression, and you have a higher likelihood to act out sexually. So it kind of makes sense with some of this stuff. I mean, that doesn't mean you're going to become a killer because you mature quickly, but I see where all the other stuff comes from. Like, you know, like the acting out, being provocative, sexually active earlier, all that stuff. Being angry because you don't feel like you belong to your body or your body is right for your age. Like, that could really cause a lot of inner turmoil. But enough to kill your parents? I don't think so. And I think just meeting them, I mean, those two meeting each other was just tragic. That was tragedy waiting to happen. And unfortunately, it happened. And as a result, the Richardson family, it's dead. And their family will forever mourn them and will forever remember them as amazing people, and they will forever miss them. So I don't know what you could really take from the story besides to take care of our youth and make sure that you're really watching your kids and you're seeing any signs or changes. Like, that's so important. And I'm sorry, but if your kid is dating a man or a woman and they are a child, call the police. Because had the Richardsons called the police, maybe something could have been changed. Something different could have happened. But this is not to place blame on anybody whatsoever. But it's just trying to take a lesson away, I guess, or something that we could learn so this could never be repeated. And also, just take care of your kids. If you don't want kids, don't have kids. You know, like, to have children, to abuse them, like, is just so scary and disturbing. And as for Jeremy claiming that he was a 300-year-old werewolf, I feel like this is a lot like the last case I covered with Rod Farrell, in the sense that he was looking for a place to belong and looking for an escape. And I think escaping to this fantasy world is what got him through. It was almost like a coping mechanism and a way to just exist in his own reality. I don't think it's much more than that. Do I think he really truly believed he was a werewolf? I don't know. I think he really badly wanted to be one, but I doubt he changed into a werewolf every night. And if he did, I think we'd know by now. Unless they're trying to cover it up and it's all a conspiracy. But we're not going to go there. So that was today's case. This was really a heavy one, especially because of 8-year-old Jacob, who deserved much better. His whole family deserved much better. And they fought so hard to have a good life, all for it to turn out like this. Like, it is just these cases, man. Some of them just make you say, what the hell? But I hope you enjoyed my take on today's case and my presentation of it. If you have any case suggestions, I'm always willing to hear it. So you can send me an email at crimeghoul5@gmail.com. Head over to Instagram at crimeghoul_, where you can help your girl out by giving me a follow or liking some of my posts. Not to mention, if you click the link tree in my bio, you can have access to all different things, like where my podcast is and ways that you can help me. You can help support me as a podcaster through there if you would like to. So think about helping your girl out. Otherwise, just sharing this podcast with a friend or on social media is more than enough. And following me on these platforms is more than enough. Like, thank you so much. I'm trying to get my podcast out there. I'm trying to talk about some crimes, and especially the lesser known crimes, to bring awareness to them. That really is something I like to do. So supporting the families, the victims, is also something I really like to do. So think about going to Instagram, checking me out. I'm on TikTok under Crime Ghoul as well. I'm on every social media platform. You could find me on Twitter, Facebook, whatever. You'll find me. But regardless, any way you can help, whether it's donating to the show or just sharing my name, Crime Ghoul, or sharing my podcast, or just even listening, is enough for me. If you've made it this far, thank you so much. I'm glad you like to hear me ramble about true crime cases. So until next time, friends, I hope you have an amazing spooky Halloween. Watch all the horror movies and spooky movies and shows. Eat all the candy, stuff your face full of Kit Kats, and be unapologetic about it. And just enjoy it, because, man, these holidays go way too fast. And I hope to see you for next week's case, so definitely tune in. And on top of that, we are going to have a Delphi case update, because if you've heard, if you're, you know, on the true crime scene like I am, you will have heard that there has been an arrest made in connection with the Delphi murders of 2017. If you don't know about that case, go check out my episode. It is on my podcast. So whether you listen on Apple, Spotify, wherever, you can find the episode by just typing in like Crime Ghoul Delphi, and you'll see my coverage of the case. But regardless, if you are listening to this on Halloween morning, there will be a press conference about the new update at 11 a.m. So I'm sure you can find that on the news, or go over to my Facebook. I'm going to try to stream it live, and that way we can all watch it and talk about it, because this is crazy. We've been waiting for an update. We've been waiting for this family to find justice. So I really hope that this is it. I hope they've got the guy, the bridge guy. I hope it's it. And if it's not, I don't know. But regardless, at some point, I'm going to release a case update, since this is such huge news. So even if it's only a few minutes, I will post it to Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. You'll be able to hear it as a bonus episode. So look out for that. And I hope to see you guys soon. And I hope to hear from you soon. Feel free to talk to me on social media. I'm always up for a good conversation, whether it's true crime related or not. Be safe and stay spooky, friends.